idea how much I had to pull up just now. that was supposed to be knocked loose. Yeah, it's always better to hit than be hit. that was my view back in the day. All right, good evening. We're in Joshua's chapters 3 and 4 tonight. Joshua 3 and 4 tonight. Oh, so they said no, Jaden sent you back, huh? That's it. Oh, that's funny. Apparently, yeah, well, that's, you know, junior high's a tough age. yeah, Joshua 3 and 4 tonight, really kind of another one of those chapter breaks in an unfortunate place kind of thing. 3 and 4 are kind of one big story. And one way to look at what's going on is chapters 1 through 5 of Joshua are kind of setting up the entrance to the land. We saw chapter 1, you know, where God kind of gives Joshua a pep talk. And then Joshua goes and gives the people a pep talk. Chapter 2, where then they have a repeat of the spying episode, just like their extra time in the wilderness began with a spying episode gone bad. Their time in the wilderness ends with a spying episode gone right. And so that was chapter 2, again, preparing to go in the land. And then chapters 3 and 4, they actually enter the land. And then we'll get to chapter 5 next week. And then 6 through 12 is them taking the land. So it's all kind of leading up to the moment where they're actually being to take the land. Because even more awkward for Jericho, I'm going back to a really badly drawn map here. Yeah, there's kind of Nebo where Moses died, and they're kind of around this area now, and Jericho's over here. Central Highlands here, Jerusalem would be about right here, though that doesn't factor in the story yet. Gilgal, we don't really know to this day the exact location of Gilgal, but basically it's going to be somewhere in this area. So in other words, and again, those of you who have been there, you know how you can see, you can see that whole area. That's not a very big area in terms of the miles involved, and it's very visible throughout that area. And so in one sense, Jericho could even more plainly see the people once they move across and camp at Gilgal for a few days. And they have to camp at Gilgal. By the way, anybody remember chapter 5 or you read ahead, why do they have to stay in Gilgal for a few days? Yeah, one of those scary passages in the Bible, man. You wish your parents had done that when you were eight days old like you were supposed to. I do think one of the scariest Bible passages in all the Bibles in Genesis was at chapter 38. It's not there. It's somewhere else. But when Joseph's brothers convinced the men of Shechem to circumcise themselves so that they will allow them to marry their sister Dinah. And the text says on the third day when the men were still sore. And I just, you know, that was a detail that did not need to be in the Bible. But it's there for a reason. One of the things, and this would be kind of a thing really, by the way, just honestly, Israel's story, all the way through their time, though. Even, you know, why is that story about Gilgal, you know, and they had to circumcise themselves? Well, haven't they learned, listen to God, do what you're supposed to do? I mean, they've had 40 years in the wilderness to think about this. But that's going to be one of the kind of the standard refrains all the way through their history until they get exiled and kicked out of the land is, there's all sorts of subtle things they should have been doing all along. I mean, God will get really mad about the idolatry and then some of that stuff, but all sorts of stuff they were supposed to be doing all along just as a matter of routine, like circumcision, keeping the Passover. We're going to find out in the Book of Kings, they quit keeping the Passover. I mean, all sorts of things that you think would just be kind of quintessential aspects of Jewish heritage and identity, and they don't do it. The constant sin in another direction, again with the idolatry and the social injustice, that'll get God's attention, and that's what God really sends the prophets to condemn them for. But they're not doing all this other stuff all along, which is part of the the lesson for us that if you don't do the little stuff, you're certainly not going to be doing the big stuff. You know, just kind of sometimes I see people, or you talk to teenagers enough, they think, you know, their peccadillos are little things. You know, at least I'm not sleeping around or getting drunk or, you know, whatever. Yes, but, you know, the lack of attention to little things God has talked about, what we consider little things that God has talked about, like circumcision or keeping the Passover, lead to a larger moral weakness in which the big stuff eventually comes into play as well. So, all right, that's another sermon for another day, though. Let's start with a word of prayer. Can I get a brother to lead us in that? And then we'll actually get down to... Thanks, Greg.
Dear Lord, we come before you tonight. thanking you for the time that we have to spend together to study your word. We pray, Lord, that we will take things that we hear tonight and try to apply them to our lives. We pray, Lord, that you would be with the teachers that are teaching, that they would have a recollection of the things that they have prepared, and that they may present them to us in a way that we can understand them clearly. Be with us through the rest of this week and on through our lives. Forgive us when we fail you. In Jesus' name.
Amen. Amen. All right, so let's read a little bit here, starting in chapter 3. So Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim. Again, this is after the spies have come back. We've kind of been on a couple week, 2 or 3 week detour from this part of the story. So the spies came back. The report as well, the spies report back in chapter 2 and verse 24 that God is with us, unlike the original spies 40 years before. Anyway, so Joshua rose early the next morning. They set out from Shittim. They came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and they lodged there before they passed over. And at the end of three days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people. As soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits, and like probably about half a mile. So don't get too close. Normally, where is the Ark, by the way? Normally. Say again? It's in the middle of the camp, but even more so, where is it? And where is it in the tabernacle? Yeah, and what's between it and everybody else? Layers of stuff. You know, there's the veil, and then there's the veil in the tabernacle itself, and then there's the barrier around the tabernacle. And so what's the whole point even now?
Don't see it,
don't get too close to it. Never forget the significance of the concept of the holiness of God, a holiness that demands separation from sinful humans. And so we're going to bring this thing out of the, almost never happens, right? We're going to bring it out of the most holy place. And it's going to go before you. And so, yet there shall be a distance between you and it, 2,000 cubits in length, about half a mile. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant. When you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, second time he's added that phrase, by the way, did you notice that? Before it was the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, now it's the Lord of all the earth. Why does that matter, by the way? Why does he keep saying that right now? Why do you think he says that? Yeah, so gods are local, and in particular, what's going on that they need to be reminded that their God is not just a local God or just their God. Yep, they're going to go and take on the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amuzites, Amorites, and the Jebusites. And so what they need to be reminded of is that he's not a local deity, he is a God over them as well, no matter what their gods are or their cities, or the fact that, remember what was said a second ago, you have not passed this way before, this isn't your land. And so if you know, as they struggle to overcome their cultural views of God, just like we sometimes struggle to overcome our culture's views of God, you know, what kind of cultural views of God do we struggle with today that we have to be careful with that are not biblical or not reflective of the one true God? He wants us to be happy. Yes, that's, you know, so we reduce the God of the Bible to a God of happiness, a divine therapist in the sky whose job is to help you figure out who you really are and what you really want in life. And we reduce God to a God who's just there to make me happy. What else?
Love his
Love, yeah, that's right. God is a God of love, but rather than letting God define what love is, we define what love is, and God then loves the way we have redefined love, which means that nobody goes to hell, there is no judgment, because God wants everybody to be happy, and that's how he loves us, and so that's how we should love each other, help them be happy, regardless of the moral significance of what we want or what we do. Yeah, other examples anybody think of real quick? Oh, yeah, or just, yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, he's just there, but kind of like an AWOL parent. You know, he made the world and walked away. That's the old deist view. And that's even, you know, by the way, that's even what the Bible means. I think back like in some of the Psalms, the fool has said in their heart, there is his heart, there is no God. It's not that the ancients ever really believed that there were no deities. Ancients, you know, did not have the scientific mindset that we can study our way into you know, defining God away, or we'll understand enough that God you won't exist. What that meant was what the psalmist meant when he says that is people live as though God's not paying attention, God doesn't care, there will be no accounting or accountability. And so that's what they meant. Everybody believed there'd be gods, but whether the gods, you know, kind of the, you know, like the Greek and Roman gods, right? You know, if you're clever enough, you might be able to outsmart them every once in a while and do what you want to do and get away with it. And Zeus won't know. Or even remember with Elijah, the way he taunted the prophets of Baal, you know, where's Baal right now? Well, maybe he's on, you know, maybe he's asleep, or maybe he's in the bathroom. That's literally what Elijah, you know, kind of hints at. And just like, you know, I don't know how it works in your house, but, you know, sometimes as soon as Banner and I turn our back, the Lord of the Flies breaks out downstairs. They think we don't know. And then there's a scream, and then there's blood. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I mean, kids do that with parents, right? You know, they're back in the bedroom, or they're upstairs, downstairs, and just, you know, all breaks out. So, yeah. Long story short, God's got to remind them, don't think, what he's really saying is, don't think of me the way everybody else thinks of me. Don't be affected by the culture's views of me. I am the God of all nations. And so we got this. And when the soles of the feet of the priests, let's see, verse 13, when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord, Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters shall come down from above, coming down from above shall stand in one heap. And that language is reminiscent in Hebrew, at least, of the description of what happened at the sea the last time. And so we get this, I think we've talked about this in one other session already. This is meant to be a bookend miracle that simulates, you know, they went into the wilderness through a parted body of water, the parting of the sea. Now they're leaving the wilderness, going into the promised land through a same type of miracle, with a slight difference that, you know, in the description of the parting of the sea, you know, it's the sea, so you have kind of your water on both sides. This is more a damming operation. So that he talked about, you know, standing in a heap. And so, you know, water's on this side and the rest of it drains away, which would be, you know, still, I think, a stunning thing to see. And so you will see this, the waters from above standing in one heap. And so when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water, and this parenthesis is important. Now the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of the harvest. And that time is now. We're given the date elsewhere. It's in the first month, which is the time of year that the Jordan overflows. You think it's an accident that God, you know, chose now to cross the Jordan? What's the significance of that detail? Say again. There's a lot of water. Yeah, again, if you've been there, the Jordan is not very big. You know, just seeing the Jordan in its normal season being parted is not impressive. If you've been there and I recognize what the floodplain looks like, and that floodplain is several miles wide in the springtime of the year when at the headwaters of the Jordan, which also create the Sea of Galilee, starts way up here in the mountains of Lebanon. You know, the snows melt the winter, you know, just like happens in rivers in the U.S., right, where river, you know, snow melts in the Rockies, and that's where a lot of our great rivers, at least in the western part of the country, you know, contend the flood. Or the same thing, you know, the Mississippi floods often in the spring. That's why they have the levees. I used to live in St. Louis, you know, and we had lots of levees there because, you know, you up in the Minnesota in the headwaters, and when the winter snows melt, here comes in the spring all the extra water. And so same thing here. It's a giant floodplain. Why is God doing it right now? Why did he do it in the fall? all the more so because this is much closer to a C now. This is much more than just your average, you've been to, let's see, in this part of the state, you've been to the Trinity, you've been to the Brazos, you've been to the Colorado, maybe you go a little bit further in the state. Parting, that's not, I mean, it'd still be cool, see the water state, but it's not big. But when it's flood stage and that floodplain is several miles wide, and God's going to shove all that water back, he's picking the right time of year to maximize the demonstration of what he's doing. And that's why that detail is there. The Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of the harvest. And the waters coming down from above stood up and rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is by Zarethan. And those flowing down toward the Sea of Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. In other words, the river just kind of drains away all the way to the Dead Sea. And the people passed over opposite Jericho. So God does this again to, signal to the Canaanites who are watching the enormity of his power. Because remember, what did Rahab, when the spies were in Jericho, tell them? We're afraid of you. Why? Because we've heard the stories. And now what you've got to understand, again, if you've been there, Jericho can see it. If you're looking out from the walls of Jericho, you can see this. And so now we've gone from we've heard these stories to your God is doing it right in front of our eyes. If you happen to be on the walls of Jericho that day and you're looking, you can see this. And so they do this across from Jericho. And the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant stood firmly. And look at the language there. On dry ground. Anybody have any different translation? Good. No. Because in Hebrew, again, it strongly emphasizes it's dry. Not, now stop and think about it. One of the things I had to get used to when I moved to Texas, I come from Florida, okay? And I come from like Central Florida. When you get away from the Panhandle, which we call that Southern Alabama, that's not real Florida. When you get into the peninsula of Florida proper, the whole thing's a giant sandbar on top of limestone. That's why we have sinkholes so much in Florida, because limestone's a very crumbly rock. And so Florida, mostly, we get our water from an aquifer under the state. And so as you draw the water out of the aquifer, as we pump, the limestone crumbles. That's why we have so many sinkholes in Florida. And there's, just like in Texas, you talk about, there's only two types of houses, those that have foundation problems and those that will have foundation problems. At least that's the way it was when I lived in Dallas. In Florida, it's that way with sinkholes, the big ones make the news, but everybody's got a little crumbling going on somewhere on their property if you stay on your property long enough. But one of the things that happens, though, is because there's such a big aquifer in Florida, it's just a sandbar. It's all Florida really is. It's a sandbar over limestone, which means when it rains, the ground is dry in an hour after it rains. That was one of the weirdest things for me moving to Florida. Moving to Texas. Because you'd have a hurricane come through in Florida, and it's dry 2 hours later. Just because the ground is just a sponge. It's sand on limestone. It goes away into the aquifer. And then I moved to Texas with this clay soil. And, you get a slight rainstorm and my yard is still wet 3 days later. Very different idea. So think about it that way. When ground has been wet, it takes a while to dry out. And so what you picture is, the water goes away, and maybe it's a muddy bottom. But the text is very explicit, and the Hebrew strongly indicates this. The ground is not just, it's been damp or it's been wet. The water's out there. It is dry. Part of the miracle, this is unnatural. This isn't we dammed it, and now the water's got to dry, the ground's got to dry out. Like if we put a dam on a river. The ground is dry. And that detail matters, again, to emphasize this is not a natural thing that has happened. This is utterly unnatural. The ground is dry until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan. And when all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, then the Lord said to Joshua, take 12 men from the people, from each tribe a man, and command them, saying, take 12 stones from here. And I'm guessing each man, each tribe gets a stone. Take 12 stones from here out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you, and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight. And so Joshua called the 12 men from the people of Israel, who he had appointed, a man from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, pass on before the ark of the Lord your God in the midst of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, that this may be a sign among you. When your children ask in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off from before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when it passed over the Jordan, and the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. And the people of Israel did just as Joshua had commanded. They took up the 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, just as the Lord told Joshua. And they carried them over with them into the place where they had lodged and laid them down there. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, also in the place where the feet of the priests bearing the ark had stood. And they are there to this day. So you have seen apparently two memorials, one in the river that will go back under the water when it returns, and one on ground, kind of mirroring each other, two sides of this miracle. And they are there to this day. And why would the narrator put it that way? It's still there if you want to go see them as a reminder. What's the point of a memorial? Not for the people who saw it. It's for those coming, right? For the priests bearing the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord commanded Joshua to tell the people, according to all that the Moses had commanded Joshua. And the people passed over in haste. And when all the people had finished passing over, the ark of the Lord and the priests passed over before the people. The sons of Reuben, sons of Gad, half tribe of Manasseh, also passed over armed before the people of Israel, as Moses had told them. About 40,000 ready for war passed over before the Lord for battle to the plains of Jericho. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua. This is important. Something we saw in chapter 3 that's reaffirmed here, that this was God elevating Joshua in the eyes of the people. God did this for Moses once, and now God's doing it for Joshua. And just like Moses tells the people, you know, stand back and watch what God does, here's Joshua telling the people, basically watch what God's going to do. And so remember, going back all the way back to chapter 1, where Joshua, God's kind of nudging Joshua to step into Moses' role. You know, God's also doing his part to do great things around Joshua as signs that Joshua is God's guy. And so God exalted, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they stood in awe of him, just as they had stood in awe of Moses all the days of him. It's like a press conference, right? When the new CEO and the old CEO kind of appear together. I mean, that's, you know, what God, you know, appearances matter, and God knows that. And so God is building Joshua up in front of the people. And the Lord said to Joshua, command the priests bearing the ark of the testimony to come up out of the Jordan. So Joshua commanded the priests, come up out of the Jordan. And when the priests bearing the ark of the covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up on dry ground, the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. Went back to flood season on the Jordan. Amazing. And the people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, again emphasizing it's springtime, and they encamped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And by the fact that it's the 10th day of the first month is important also. Why? It doesn't just tell us it's spring and help us understand it's flood season for the Jordan. Well, say again?
Passover.
10th day is when you pick your Passover lamb for the 14th, which is the Passover. And so, and that's what we're also going to see happen here at Gilgal. We got to do some circumcising, and we got to do some celebrating. So it's also important, not just does God imitate the sign in terms of leaving Egypt and then leaving the waters going to the promised land, but he does it at exactly the same season. You left Egypt at the Passover, and when are you going into the promised land? At the Passover, because God likes his patterns. He likes to keep things balanced. And so it happens on the 10th day of the first month, and they encamped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, when your children, second time he said that the text has said this, when your children ask their fathers in times to come, what do these stones mean? Then you shall let your children know. Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. That's the miracle. People's always crossed rivers, and we've got ancient carvings and reliefs of armies crossing rivers. I mean, they do that. Crossing a river is not a big deal. Crossing it on dry ground, yeah, that's a big deal. And so that's what these stones mean. Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground, for the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea when he dried up for us until we passed over, so that all the peoples of this earth may know. Starting with the Canaanites, right? What did Rahab tell the spies? We take your God seriously because we've heard the stories. Our gods don't do things like this. Apparently your God does. And so that all the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty and that you may fear the Lord your God forever. All right, let's look at some things from the story, some other details we haven't brought out yet, and then we'll try to make some points, and then the bell will probably catch us. What's one of the most common recurring words in chapters 3 and 4? It's one of the most frequently repeated words. Anybody pick it up? Yeah, that actually verb is used a lot, and I think it's intentionally so, because it's meant to mimic. And ironically, except in inverse order, if you look at it this way, that the way it worked is you had firstborn, and then Exodus, Exodus and the sea. And now what's happening on the other side of the wilderness is you're doing Exodus and sea. And then comes the slaughter of the firstborn, only now it's not just firstborn, but he's going to slaughter Jericho. He's going to destroy Jericho, right? Same type of thing, judgment against Egypt, judgment against Canaan. And, but we're going in reverse order this time. Everybody see that? That makes sense? So I think that's part of, you're right, Rebecca, that is one of the most common words, that verb for passing over, which is meant, I think, to echo a little bit what's going on. There's another word, too, though. That's common, but I'm looking for a noun, actually. I should be more specific. That's good, but and you're on the right track, but that's not the actual word. Ark. You notice how many times the ark is mentioned? It's all over the place. After a while, you think we got the point. The ark is out, the ark is about. But the ark is repeated almost to the point of being annoying. Why repeat it so many times? It's important, yeah, because what's it really saying about who's there? The ark, remember, the ark is part of why we're keeping our distance from it, going back to earlier in chapter 3, right? 2,000 cubits and don't get near it and all that. Standard rules apply, just like Sinai. But the ark, more than anything else, is meant to depict what to Israel? The actual presence of God himself. And on this particular day, God has left his tent, and God is literally walking among them as the priests carry his footstool or his throne, depending on which metaphor and which passage you want to use. But God has literally come out of his tent, and God is physically, really present among them in a powerful way. Why does that matter? Because when this happened the first time, there was no ark yet, right? The ark had not been built yet. So what instead did Israel see? God was visibly present to them. Not in the sense that anybody saw God. Because remember what the cloud was. The cloud was not God. The cloud was what God was kind of swaddled in, because to see God is to die. Because the point was his presence, his true presence was there. And so the cloud comes down on Sinai later. I mean, whatever God is, before he goes into the tabernacle, it's a cloud. And the cloud is your protection from his presence, because he has come down. But now, because and when they move in the tabernacle, what happens? The cloud goes in, remember, and the glory pushes Moses back. Why? Because God has moved in and dropped his cloud for a bit, as it were, and the glory is overwhelming, and so Moses gets driven back. And the same thing will happen when Solomon builds the temple and God moves in there. The actual presence of God is so overwhelming, it drives everybody back, lest anybody's killed. And so now you have the ark. So how does, now, rather than using the pillar of fire and cloud, how does God show that I am literally out again leading you? The ark. And so the text just beats and beats and beats that point. The ark, the ark, the ark, the ark. God has come out of the tent again, and just like here, he is physically leading his people. He led them out of Egypt, and now he is actually leading them. And that part, that I think that also helps us make sense a little bit of why that's the point at which the text indicates that God really exalted Joshua. Because how did God exalt Moses? I mean, he had the signs he could do, but did that really get Israel's attention? How did God really exalt Moses? When Moses, is this thing, stand back and see what great things your Lord does for you when they're stuck against the sea and Egypt's bearing down on them. And so Moses is forever connected with that great miracle. And now Joshua is suddenly connected with this great miracle that depends upon the divine presence in an extraordinary way. What's interesting about that as well is that, as much as we talked about kind of parallels between Joshua and Jesus, Just as God had to kind of build Joshua's resume to the people, there's a sense in which when you go back to the Gospels, is that not true as well of Jesus? You know, what were the purposes of Jesus' signs? To show what? Yeah, that he's God, but also, and also that God is with him. I mean, you know, it's kind of a little complicated, but depending on what passage you read, but that ultimately God is with him. And that's part of why Jesus kind of becomes controversial, because, you know, then people can debate about Jesus, you know, but we know he's done great things and God doesn't listen to sinners, so he can't be a sinner. But that's the whole issue of establishing him in front of the people with these great signs and wonders. And just like Joshua has to kind of come out from Moses' shadow, what's the biggest reason that the religious leaders of Jesus' day are choking on him? Because they're pitting him against Moses. But, you know, when Jesus talks about divorce and remarriage, who do they push back on Jesus with? Well, but Moses said, you know, and so again, Moses is this great shadow that kind of hangs over that, you know, and Jesus, or think about the Sermon on the Mount, right? They were shocked because Jesus taught as one having, you know, he's got to come out from Moses' shadow where before, you know, all the rabbis and everything else, all they're doing is giving their opinions about what Moses said or what Moses meant. But all of a sudden, here comes Jesus who sits down and teaches with authority. Or, you know, again, opens the scroll of Isaiah there in the Nazareth synagogue that one day. And then, Nazareth or Capernaum, I can't remember. Nazareth. It was Nazareth. And then he says what when he finishes reading that? Today, this is what? Been fulfilled in your hearing. And so here's part of what, you know, and Jesus elsewhere, I think it's in John's gospel, you know, if you don't believe the words, believe the signs. You know, look at what God is doing with me and through me. You know, you don't like my teaching, okay, but the signs are kind of hard to argue with. And to the point that even in the New Testament, right, you know, Jewish Christians struggled to get Jesus out from under Moses. Right? Because that's the whole issue of Jewish Christians wanting Gentiles to what? Yeah, be circumcised and keep other aspects of the law of Moses to be saved. Or you get the book of Hebrews, which we've already referenced this quarter because of its use of Joshua and coming out of the wilderness. Joshua did not give them real rest. Jesus gives us real rest. He's the true Joshua in that sense. But right before that great chapter 3, chapter 4 section in which the Hebrew writer indicates Jesus is the one who gives real rest in a true promised land, he starts in chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, and talks about how Jesus is not Moses. He's still got, you know, again, this constant struggle. Moses was such a figure that it was the struggle of the Joshuas, if you will, to emerge from his shadow. And so God glorifies both these men to try to establish that Moses was not the end. Moses was just a means to something else. And so both Joshuas, as it were, have to be elevated by God to that role. All right. What else do we want to do here real quick for sake of time? I think for sake of time, just want to notice a couple of other things. Again, you know, patterns between the old and the new. Wondrous miracle that is meant to be commemorated with a memorial. When we do it here, you know, kind of is associated with the Passover, and the Passover is kind of, you know, forever connected with that story. When we do it here, we set up the rocks, you know, the 12 rocks to memorialize when he brings the 12 stones. Yes, ma'am.
Are they still here?
Huh?
Are they still here?
I'm sure the rocks are somewhere. I'm just not sure where. I don't think so. I mean, I would think that they'd be long gone after these centuries. Kind of like Noah's Ark. It rested on Ararat, but by now, I don't think that I don't think they were miraculously maintained like to this day. I would think after this many centuries of, you know, millennia of floods and, you know, because remember too, the Israel that they were meant to serve as a memorial for does not exist anymore. You know, right? Modern Israel is not ancient Israel. The people of God that those were meant to serve as a lesson for to this day, as the text puts it, is a generation that was destroyed in the exile, you know, what, 2,500 years ago now. And so those folks have lost the land. In one sense, that memorial's purpose has been fulfilled and even severed. Because, you know, ironically, when you go back to the point that the text makes, verse 24, so that all the peoples may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty and that you may fear the Lord your God forever. Well, oops. That didn't exactly happen for them, did it? And so eventually they lose the land. In fact, one of the paradoxes I might add, when they do lose, you know, the Jerusalem falls right to the Babylonians, when and Zedekiah makes a run for it. You go back and you read in Kings and Chronicles about the end of their time in the land. You know, the Babylonians have come, and Jerusalem is falling, and Zedekiah does what all great and noble leaders does. He runs. Where he's running, the text gives details about where he's running. The paradox is he's running literally the reverse path. He's caught before he gets to the Jordan, but he's running the reverse path. Strategically, it made sense. Babylon came down this way, so you would run this way. But the text wants us to know where he was running. He was literally the opposite journey out of the land. Probably also, by the way, slight detail. When Elijah leaves this world in a most unnatural way, he leaves in this area. This is the area in which he is taken up to heaven. Remember he and Elisha go down to the Jordan, and it's in this area. And part of the idea, again, there may be, because Elijah was meant to be God's great spiritual warrior against the decay of the northern kingdom. But the northern kingdom wasn't listening, right? Remember? And so kind of God's way of, again, saying, I'm leaving the land, you know, or this is what's the risk of, because he goes down, he smites the Jordan. Remember the Jordan parts? Yeah. Remember all that? That's significant. That happens here. What's that all about? God's way of saying you're on thin ice. You're on real thin ice with me right now. Because, you know, going down by around Gilgal and Jericho and parting the Jordan, that's an echo of something. That's when we came into the land, and now here's Elijah leaving, so to speak. But here's the thing, going back to the memorials for a second. So there's these memorials that literally kind of are meant to remind. And the text is explicit. When your children ask you about this, the importance of memorials, does the newer Joshua leave us similarly with memorials that are meant to teach? And the correct answer is absolutely. Anybody think of what memorials we have today that have been left by the new Joshua? One of them is the Lord's Supper, right? You know, he explicitly says this is a memorial to remember what I do in this great Exodus moment, as the new covenant comes online. And so he leaves us a memorial feast. Any other memorial? We don't often think about this one this way. Say again? Yeah, I would consider prayer more of a spiritual discipline. Bell just rang, so I'll just go ahead and get right to it. We don't think of this one, but baptism. Is baptism linked not just to something you do for forgiveness of sins, but is it linked to the Christ event in a way of imitating the Christ event? And the correct answer is, yes, it is. What does Paul say, for instance, in Romans 6 about it? You have been what? Yeah, and so all that, well, why does burial matter in talking about baptism? Because it's an imitation of, a reflection or a reminder of his death, burial, and resurrection. And that's not what we talk about when we talk about baptism sometimes. And so it functions not just as something that is, you know, an act required for salvation, you know, step number 5 in the 5 steps, but it's literally, in its imagery, meant to also serve as a memorial, a reminder of what's been done and how we are saved as well, where we mimic the Christ act itself that led to eternal life for him. Does that make sense? And so, yes, so the new Joshua as well has left us with memorials that we use to teach our children, or at least ought to be, that are meant to, you know, our children. And then most of us, you know, who raise kids in the church, you know, our kids ask us questions, right? I mean, my kids went through phases. They wanted to pretend the Lord's Supper at home with crackers and whatever they were drinking that day. I mean, just, you're right, most of your kids do something similar. And it becomes a conversation, right? You know, and something they grow and they learn the real significance of with that. and so on and so forth. Anyways, all right. So that just reminds the importance of stories in teaching the next generation. It's not just a moral code to live by. Our God has done certain things that no other God and nothing else that claims to be a God has done. And so part of what it means to be a Christian is not just you live a certain moral code, is that you tell certain stories that you believe are true because God has done these things. That's what makes you a Christian. Not that you don't sleep around or get drunk. What makes you a Christian is you believe God raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. That makes sense? That's what makes you a Christian. Lots of other religions say don't sleep around and don't get drunk. What makes you a Christian is God has done this thing. So, all right. See you next week.